fantasy readers. This is Corinne Norton, your fellow book binger, and you are listening to the Finding Fantasy Reads podcast, where you can test out a new fantasy story every single week to find your next favorite author. We're ending this season with an epic fantasy short story from an author many of you already know and love. Jeff Wheeler is a Wall Street Journal best-selling author with over 30 epic fantasy novels, including the King Fountain and Muirwood series. He's known for having clean, compelling fantasy with strong moral protagonists, complex characters, and richly detailed worlds. This particular story is connected to his Muirwood series, so be prepared to hop online after listening so you can find and binge the rest of it. Today's narrator is Peter Franson, host of Christian Geek Central. Stick around to the end or check out today's show notes to see where you can find more from both the author and the narrator, as well as how to enter our giveaway and vote for Season 2's Finding Fantasy Reads Awards. For now, please enjoy The Hunter of Muirwood by Jeff Wheeler.
John Hunter's stomach was a hive of bees that morning as he walked from his lodge at the edge of the abbey grounds. He'd left his bow and quiver by his bedstead and missed the soothing companionship of those weapons, but he had a gladius belted at his waist and a hunting dagger strapped to his thigh. He scratched his chin, and feeling the scruff there, he wondered if he should have gotten a shave in the village the previous day. Was that appropriate for a meeting with the stern Aldermaston of Muirwood Abbey? As he walked, he smelled the fish pond, not a pleasant odor, but one that was chased away as he passed the rows of purple mint growing neatly by the herb gardens of the abbey. Muirwood had been built ages before in this soggy marshland called the Beard and Muir. He knew the bog better than most, but his duty was to patrol and guard the abbey grounds and ensure that no interlopers or ruffians disturbed the students studying there. Some of the older learners liked talking to John, especially the boys, who were impressed by his knowledge of forest lore and the fact that he was allowed to carry weapons on the abbey grounds. But he didn't like talking to students. He didn't like talking to anyone. He saw the abbey rise over the swell of oak trees, its tall spire a breathtaking sight. Even though he knew the grounds intimately, he'd never been inside the abbey. That was the domain of the Maston Order and their mysterious ways. There were stones carved with faces, leering stones, which had been sculpted centuries before and added unseen protections to the abbey. Some generated light, others water. Some were wards to keep the myriad ones away. He didn't even like to think about such things. They always gave him the shudders. Sometimes the myriad ones would infest wild beasts and turn them savage. It was worse when they infected a man or woman. As he crossed the turf leading to the Aldermaston's manor on the far side of the abbey, he neared the kitchen by the cider orchard and was surprised to see Ailsa Cook out of doors. She had a bonny face and light brown hair, a little plump, but he didn't mind that at all. She noticed him and waved him over. The bees in his stomach changed the cadence of their hum. "I don't often see you wandering the grounds, John Hunter," Ailsa said in a cheery voice that made him weak-kneed. "Where are you off to?" He could hear some noise from children inside the kitchen and Pasqua scolding them. "The Aldermaston," he said simply, feeling embarrassed. Conversation was not his strength. "Oh? Is there something wrong?" Her brow tightened with worry. "A poacher in the woods?" "I do not know why he wants to see me," he said. "My name day is coming up. I shall be 18. "I know," she said with a smile. "I was going to make some gooseberry fool for you." "You do not have to," he demurred, secretly pleased that she had remembered the occasion. His neck started itching fiercely. "We have gooseberries and cream. Why not? The Aldermaston is not going to send you away, surely." She sounded confident, but there was a hint of worry in her tone. "We have a hunter already," John said with a nagging feeling. "Martin is more than capable to keep doing this for years."
"Martin is too churlish," Ailsa said. "You are pleasant."
He saw a little pink in her cheeks.
"You'd better stay."
He gave her a helpless shrug and then started to leave.
"Do Do you want some bread and honey butter? I can get some for you.
I already had some porridge, he said. His worry and embarrassment worsened, and his cheeks were probably flaming. He quickened his pace at the thought. Why did he feel so tongue-tied around her? While he was always reticent, he was never so inarticulate as with her. Ailsa was slightly older than him, and on her name day, she had chosen to remain at Muirwood. There was always need for hands in a kitchen, especially with the two little wretches the Aldermaston had given Pasqua to raise. The Aldermaston's kitchen was much smaller than the one for the learners, for it was there only to serve the Aldermaston and his infrequent guests. The head cook there, a diminutive woman named Pasqua, could talk his ears off and never lose her breath. Thankfully, she wasn't outside. He could hear her tending the two wretches who had been found at the Abbey 3 years ago and who tried her patience with their antics, especially the girl with the curly blonde hair. The dark-haired girl was a willing accomplice, though, if John had things right. He occasionally spied the little girls walking hand in hand through the cider orchard after they'd snuck outside. Ailsa was capable and clever enough to become the head cook someday. That very kitchen might be hers one day. Or maybe she'd be assigned to the learner kitchen, which required a lot of helpers. He hoped the Aldermaston wouldn't send him away. He loved being at the Abbey. Nothing would ever change that. As he walked up the steps, he gave the Abbey another cursory look. There were students up and about already, some loitering around the walled cloister, more determined to talk and joke than go inside and learn to read and engrave. Those who came from more noteworthy families were more inclined to hard work and diligence. He entered the back door of the manor and felt all the dirt and dust he brought in. He walked carefully down the hall, his boots crunching in the rush matting at the entrance, even though he tried to be quiet. As he reached the door to the Aldermaston's study, he saw Prestwich advancing. He was the Aldermaston's personal servant, a gray-haired man of nearly 70.
"Ah, John Hunter, the Aldermaston is expecting you. Welcome indeed. He asked me to give this to you."
It was a purse, a little bag, and when he handed it over, John heard the jingle of coins in it, and his sudden dread sucked every joy from him. Disappointment thrummed in his skull as if he'd taken a glancing blow from a hoof. He took the pouch, weighed it in his hand, and then nodded to Prestwich as he stuffed the pouch into his pocket. His hands were suddenly tingling, his heart racing. He needed to compose himself before knocking at the door.
"Come in,"
the Aldermaston said in his deep voice. Even through the thick door, John could hear that it was strained. Although he had dark gray hair himself and had been Aldermaston of Muirwood for decades, he wasn't as old as Prestwich. His wife had died prematurely, and he had never remarried. And though there was a look of sadness in his eyes sometimes, that wasn't a sign of weakness, for the Aldermaston had a temper. Students who misbehaved had learned that swiftly enough. There were rumors that his power with the medium was formidable. Not that John had witnessed any himself, except the usual controlling of leerings. John opened the door and saw Martin pacing inside. He had his hunter leathers on, his dark beard was grizzled, and his cowl was pulled down to reveal unkempt hair that matched his beard. He gave John a scolding look. He shut the door behind himself and crossed his wrists, unsure what to do with his hands. The Aldermaston sat behind his sturdy desk. A golden tome lay exposed before him with an array of scribing tools, and there were papers of correspondence as well, rounded scrolls, some with the wax seals still affixed. A small fire burned behind him, the smoke heading up the flue. On his mantle were some collectibles, including a spherical device perched on a stand, the Crucigeur Orb. It was one of the Aldermaston's most treasured possessions, a gift left to him by a visitor several years before, a nobleman if memory served. John Hunter returned his gaze to his host and saw the Aldermaston gazing at him angrily. He was in a dark mood, and that caused the bees to hum more stridently in John's stomach.
"Martin has decided to return to Priree," the Aldermaston said somberly.
The news caught John totally off guard. He blinked in surprise, but other than that, kept his composure.
"By Cheshire, took you long enough to say it plainly,"
the hunter growled before turning to face John. I told him you're the man for the job. I've trained you in cunning, in wood lore, in all that I know. It is past time for me to return to my own people. Comoros keeps encroaching ever more on our borders. They break every vow. I can't abide here any longer, lad. You are the new hunter of Muirwood. Me? John said in astonishment. This was unforeseen, and the Aldermaston didn't look pleased.
I would like you to stay at Muirwood, the Aldermaston said. I have confidence in you. The bag of coins Prestwich gave you are your wages earned, and there will be more if you stay. I had hoped Martin might stay on for another year or two.
He arched his dark eyebrows with a condemning look.
I cannot,
Martin said, something in his eyes and tone showing he was ill at ease. His lips twitched into a snarl.
I cannot stay. There are already too many questions.
John Hunter wondered what that meant. After Priory had fallen to the armies of Comoros, there was a nasty rivalry between the larger and smaller kingdoms. Skirmishes still broke out and had to be quelled. It almost sounded like Martin had come to Muirwood to hide. John realized how little he knew of his teacher's past. The man had been a father to him, and he was going away, maybe never to return. That made John's stomach clench with sorrow.
Will you stay?
The Aldermaston asked, drawing John's gaze back to him.
I would be honored to serve Muirwood, John said, his voice growing thick as he spoke.
The burden of responsibility felt heavy on his young shoulders. 18 seemed very young to be the hunter of Muirwood Abbey.
There's a good lad, Martin said, puffing out his chest with pride. You'll do me proud. I've no fear of that. The bog belongs to no one. This hundred belongs to the Sheriff of Mendenhall, but the grounds belong to you. See no one trespasses them, lad, or by Cheshu make them regret it if they do.
John Hunter loped through the overgrowth, where the tangle of limbs obscured the sky. His boots were smeared with mud as he followed the trail of men and one horse into the murk. He paused to examine a fresh cake of manure and wrinkled his nose at the smell. Not that it was unpleasant, but at how fresh it was. The daylight was waning quickly, and that worried him. A light drizzle pattered on the limbs and dripped down onto him. He hadn't eaten since his morning bowl of porridge. It had been several months since Martin had left, and winter was fast approaching. It was a season, with all the learners gone, when he'd spend more time tending a fire in the lodge than tramping through the Bearden Muir. Darkness and cold foiled most evil men's ambitions. He missed Martin's company, and would have valued having him there in such a circumstance. One of Martin's many adages came to mind. The hunter is patient, the prey is careless. He'd found the tracks these men had made on one of his rounds. They'd taken little care to hide their presence. 3 sets of boots and a single horse. 4 people, possibly, unless the horse was only a pack animal and didn't bear a rider. They had followed the wall of the abbey until it reached the edge of the fens, and then had been snaking around the abbey's perimeter in a meandering path that may have seemed innocuous to most, but it was obvious to him that they were there deliberately, and that was why John was hunting them. Someone lost would have gone to the abbey for assistance. These men were trying to conceal themselves, and doing a poor job of it. John wondered at their destination, and tried to use the logic that Martin had instilled in him. The front gates of the abbey were closed at night, except during the Whitsunday festival. The walls enclosed most of the abbey, except where the woods became a natural barrier. Sometimes people climbed to the tor to enjoy a view of the region, but the evidence in front of him did not support that being the case for this group. The most valuable things in Muirwood were at the Aldermaston's manor, the abbey, and the cloisters. The cloisters, which were locked and guarded, contained much of the abbey wealth through the precious metal called auriculcum. The abbey's industry, apple cider, was stored in kegs and barrels and was much more difficult to steal since it needed to be transported by wagon. He continued to follow the trail, and it finally emerged from the woods to approach the abbey from behind. As dusk was descending, he knew it would be difficult to see them and they him, so he ventured cautiously forward, keeping low, an arrow at the ready. In this section of the grounds, a sharp slope led up to the Abbey Cemetery at the top of the rise, and he found them near its base. The steep hill, dotted with boulders, led up to a thick grove of oak trees where the horse was tethered to a stump. The whole area was mottled with ancient oaks, some with branches drooping so low they brushed the turf. The men had not built a fire. He approached quietly and deftly until he was close enough to see, then kept himself hidden behind a tree. There were two men, both standing at the base of the steep rise, complaining about the cold and the wet.
"Miserable as rats out here,"
one of them muttered.
"I'd rather be enjoying that ale at the Pilgrim Inn." "Tosh it! We'll get our drink if we can bring back something of worth. Everything's just like he said." "He's a liar. You know that as well as I." "But he wasn't lying about this, was he? Look how easy it's been."
John Hunter couldn't see anyone else, so he felt these two were guarding a way to escape. There was a road not far from the tree line leading to Mendenhall. By entering the abbey on the far side and going around, it had disguised the intention of their approach. What were they after? He waited patiently, listening to their whining further, hoping to get more information. Someone had tipped them off about something. Who? How many more were involved? Was there a fourth man? What he did know was they had separated from each other, and that had been careless. Neither of these wormy-looking fellows looked threatening to him. From what little he could see in the gloom, they were dressed as beggars. Their language also revealed their poverty. He knew how to talk like that. Martin had always insisted on being able to blend in with surroundings, whether it was the woods or a tavern. But having been raised at Muirwood, he could also speak in the formal way of the learners. The Aldermaston expected those who lived at the abbey to be more refined. He made his decision and acted. He put the arrow back in the quiver and swung the bow to his back. Without any weapons in hand, John Hunter prowled forward, careful not to snap twigs or reveal himself, and with the steady moisture of late, things were not as brittle, so the damp helped muffle his sounds. He approached tree to tree, keeping the fellows in view until he was nearly on them. The horse snorted, turning its head toward him. John attacked. He kicked the first man in the stomach so hard it knocked him clear off his feet. He hoped the blow would steal his breath away and prevent him crying out. The other, John surprised with a headlock and quickly choked off his air, rendering him unconscious in only a few moments. Drawing his dagger, he stalked to the first man, who was bent double and wheezing, trying to catch his breath. The man had a wild look in his eyes as John loomed over him, and he opened his mouth to let out a yell. John clubbed him in the temple with the dagger pommel to knock him out. The horse snickered and shied from him, but John knew all the tricks to tame beasts and quickly settled the animal. He had an apple in his pocket from cold storage, which he had just remembered, and fed it to the beast to quiet it. Then he trussed up the two men with leather thongs and bound their mouths with gags. The effort took longer than he'd hoped, but he was quick and efficient, choosing to let them live so they could be questioned later. It was too dark to see the trail the others had made, so John Hunter sheathed his dagger and readied his bow again and began to climb up the steep hill. He was anxious to get up there, knowing the abbey was vulnerable without him nearby, but he needed to be patient. As he neared the top, he heard the hiss and thunk of shovels and men muttering quietly. The abbey cemetery at the top of the hill was shielded from view by the steepness of the slope he climbed and by a screen of oak trees on its other side. Most learners didn't care to roam the cemetery, so it was a lesser-known area of the abbey grounds. The bones of the dead were put in stone ossuaries to preserve them and stacked in rows atop each other until a new row was needed. Since the abbey's founding, many bodies had been placed there, awaiting the day when the medium would revive them. That was a peculiar Maston belief that this life was but an interlude before another one. He reached the top and cautiously squatted behind a protruding boulder to get a look. There were two men digging, and they'd already produced a mound of dirt. One of the shovels struck stone.
"Found it!"
gasped one of the men. John Hunter scowled in fury. They were grave robbers, come to despoil the abbey's cemetery. They'd planned their arrival for after sundown so that they could work all night, stealing from the ossuaries, and slip out on the road.
"Come on, help me dig out the rest. Where's the rope?"
"We got enough rope," muttered the other. "Come on, put your back into it."
They kept huffing and digging. John Hunter crept away from the boulder. He lifted his bow and aimed for one of their legs. They weren't using lamps, so John had to rely on the ambient light coming from the sky. He let the shaft fly. The arrow pierced the man's leg, and he let out a cry of pain before dropping down with an agonized moan. John Hunter rushed to the scene, where the other man came at him with the shovel he wielded. John ducked the blow and then smashed the heel of his palm into the man's chin. That stunned him, so John dropped his bow and wrestled the man for his shovel. He easily overpowered his opponent, who quailed and began gibbering with fear.
"Don't kill me! Don't kill me!"
John flung the shovel aside and kicked the man onto his back.
"Who sent you?" he demanded.
"It was just a job! Just a job!"
the man sniveled. John heard the familiar clap and whine of a crossbow an instant before pain shot through his upper arm. There had been a fifth man? He realized his error, realized he had rushed to judgment. How Martin would have chided him for not being more patient. John didn't know where the next adversary was. The fellow he'd shot was still moaning in pain, and the one before him was still groveling. John spun and then fell down. His arm blazed with pain, but the arrow had only grazed him. Being low to the ground amidst the other fellows would make him a harder target. He cursed himself for being too self-confident. He lay still.
"Barrack got him," said the sniveling man. "He got him! Barrack, he's dead!"
"Help me, you fool," moaned the other man. "He shot my leg."
"Of course he did. He's the hunter, just like Scarseth said. But we got him. We got him."
The name was vaguely familiar. There had been a wretched at the Abbey, a few years older than John, who had craved being the hunter of Muirwood. Instead, the Aldermaston had made him a page to deliver messages, and he'd resented it. His name was Seth. And he'd abandoned the Abbey after he'd been caught committing a despicable deed by John himself. Martin had always had a soft spot for Seth and had taught him a few things, but he had not given Seth the training that John had received because trust was the most important requirement for anyone in that role. John had proved his trustworthiness and dependability. Seth had fled the Abbey before Martin could be told of his vile deed, so Seth had avoided punishment. He'd not even received a bag of coins to reward him for years of service at the Abbey and to help him make his start in the world. Had he changed his name and begun running with grave robbers? John controlled his breathing to make it seem like he was dead, all the while listening keenly, and then heard the telltale sounds of someone approaching, someone who still had a crossbow. Was this his old rival, the boy whom he'd fought with so often until John had outgrown him?
"Barrack, get over here!"
hissed the other man as he stood. He prodded John with his boot, but John didn't react to it.
"They'll cut off my leg. I know it. It's ruined. Oh, how it hurts. Quit your whining, you dolt. Barrack, see? He's dead. You got him."
"I don't see an arrow sticking in him," said a new voice from a few paces away.
John rolled to the side, drawing his dagger with the motion, and let it fly. He was aiming for the fellow's heart, and if the man hadn't been holding a crossbow, it would have struck true. Cries of surprise came from the men as the dagger hit the crossbow instead, which triggered the bolt and sent it winging at him again. But John Hunter, ignoring the flames of pain in his arm and already rolled to the side, rose and rushed the newcomer, tackling him backward. The fellow was a giant of a man, but the surprise knocked him down and made him drop the heavy weapon. John began to smite his face with his fists, but an elbow came at him, knocking John in the chin. The man rolled, and John knew he'd be squashed beneath him, so he let go and flung himself around. The other man, the uninjured one, began running away and was soon lost over the edge of the hill. The big man, Barrack, made it to his feet and faced off with the hunter.
"He said you'd be quick."
The man was huge. John had smelled a metallic scent when he'd been close and realized the fellow was wearing a hauberk. He would have had some protection against John's arrows that way, and it implied he was much more than just a corpse thief. Hauberks cost too much for a simple highwayman.
"Who are you?" John demanded coldly. "Oh, just a soldier down on his luck," the other said with a smile in his voice. "Been waiting for you, lad. Scarseth knew you'd come."
John was panting and tried slowing his breath. Then the man was lumbering at him, hands outstretched to snag the hunter in a powerful grasp. John evaded the lunge and kicked the man in the side, but it didn't slow the man at all. A fist nicked John's cheekbone, creating a splash of stars in his vision. Then they were both on the ground again, colliding with the fellow with the damaged leg, who roared with pain as the arrow snapped in half and the bodkin tip dug deeper. A man Beric's size shouldn't be so quick. All John's training began to slosh around in his mind as he tried to adapt to the dark and find the fellow's eyes, his throat, some vulnerable spot. He heard the man growl in pain, and then a blow caught John on the side of the head, a blow that sent him down into the heath, stunned. For a moment, he was insensible, but the man had seized him again and was trying to lift him up, probably to throw him or just squeeze him until his ribs broke. John clenched his teeth and lowered his posture, trying to make himself more cumbersome. He also tried to free his arms, but they were pinned, and the man was stronger than he was, so he rocked his head back and felt it connect with the fellow's chin. Still, the pressure increased, so he did it again, and that time caused some slack, enough to grab one of the man's arms. He snaked his boot behind the man's ankle, aiming to lever him over his back, but the man was trained in war and clubbed his fist into John's neck. The fight would be over in seconds if he didn't find a way to free himself. He'd already thrown his dagger, and drawing the gladius would take too long.
"You're a difficult one, I'll give you that,"
Beric snarled, panting. He managed to get his fingers into John's hair and twist. John, half-turned, realized he was right where he needed to be and stomped on the man's foot with the heel of his boot. He stomped hard enough to break a piece of wood, hard enough to break the man's foot. It was one of Martin's favored techniques for close quarters. He heard the telltale noise, and then the man bellowed in rage and pain as he went down. John kicked him in the head after he'd fallen, which ended the row. He panted, grateful that he'd won the day. 5-1. Not good odds by Cheshu, but still, John had won.
"Don't kill me, Hunter! I beg you, by the medium, spare me!"
It was the other fellow with pain in his voice, lying on his back with the stub of an arrow sticking out of his leg. Martin grabbed his bow and hurried to the boulder he'd hidden behind when reaching the top of the hill. He heard the horse nickering and saw that the grave robber who had fled the cemetery had untied the other two in order to escape. From his position on the hilltop, he had just enough light to make out the smudges in the dark. He sent 3 arrows down the hillside, 1 into each man, and spared the horse. John sat gingerly on the stool in Pasqua's kitchen, accepting the bowl of fragrant apple soup from the talkative cook. The interior of the kitchen always had heady aromas of baking bread, of cheese, of ginger and rosemary and sugary treats, especially the few days before Whitsunday when the tables overflowed with Pasqua's delights.
"Look at you, poor man," Pasqua said with a cluck of her tongue. "Let me fetch you a mug of cider as well. You're as filthy as the hog pens, but how brave. I'm sure the Aldermaston is pleased with you. Pleased, though he probably doesn't show it, grouchy old niffler."
It was late. John was exhausted, but the soup tasted wonderful, and he kept spooning it in his mouth to sate his hunger. His shoulder still stung. The patter of bare feet came on the stone, and the 2 little wretched girls came up to him, eyes eager with the excitement of a stranger in the kitchen. Pasqua stamped her foot.
"Ailsa, I told you to put those girls to bed in the loft."
"I did, Pasqua," Ailsa said, coming forward. She tousled the blonde girl's hair and gave her a tender smile. "How can they sleep with such excitement?"
"Leah, Zoe, get back up the ladder," Pasqua scolded. "The hunter of Muirwood needs to eat his soup."
"I'm all right," John said to Pasqua.
"No, you're not,"
Ailsa said with alarm, noticing the torn sleeve and blood stain on his shoulder.
You're injured.
It's nothing.
Nothing, my eye, Pasqua exclaimed. Have you been dripping blood on my clean floor? Leah, go get the woad. Zoe, fill a mug of cider from the larder. Walk carefully, don't spill.
Yes, Pasqua, said the little girl.
How many of them did you kill?
Leah asked sweetly.
Leah, of all the questions to ask, where's that broom? I need to sweep the floor all over again.
As Pasqua bustled away, John Hunter gave Leah a knowing look and held his forefinger down with his thumb, extending the other three fingers.
Three?
Leah whispered excitedly. John nodded and then turned somber as the pot of ground woad was brought by Elsa instead. The two prisoners had been carted off to the healer, and Humphrey Smith was standing guard over there while their injuries were tended. The Aldermaston had authority over life and death, and had not decided yet what to do with the two men. One of the hunter's roles, rarely done, was that of executioner.
"Let me see how bad it is," Ailsa said, kneeling by John's stool.
She smelled pretty, like cloves.
"I can mend it,"
he offered, but she brooked no refusal and helped roll up his sleeve. He felt uncomfortable. Leah came close, peering at the gaping wound with interest and no amount of fear. Her companion Zoe was afraid of many things, but Leah had a sense of fearlessness to her. She was always up to some mischief or other, which was exasperating to Pasqua. But he knew Ailsa loved the girls and was very patient with them. Hunters noticed things. After he put his empty bowl down, she dipped a rag in water and carefully cleaned the wound. Even though it stung, he kept himself from reacting to the pain. Then Ailsa applied some of the ground woad to the wound, which would help cleanse it and staunch the blood seeping through the scabs. Had Beric been intending to kill him? He wondered if the goal had been more to humiliate the hunter than to defile the ossuaries and steal precious valuables from inside them. That was just the sort of thing Seth would do.
"That should do it," Ailsa said. "It will be sore for a few days, but the woad should help it heal."
"Thank you,"
John said, looking into her eyes and feeling that fluttering sensation in his stomach again.
"We are lucky to have you as our hunter," she said, giving him a warm smile. "Do you know who they were and why they came?"
He suspected, but he shook his head no as he looked around the space. The racks and spits and hanging pots and sieves were all familiar to him. The outside of the Aldermaston's kitchen was square-shaped, but the interior had eight sides, owing to the chimneys in the corners, and the tall, sloping roof had a covered cupola that allowed the smoke to escape the building. His eyes rested on the window above the door where he'd caught Seth peeking in so many years earlier. He'd been watching Ailsa bathing, and John had thrashed him for it. He'd been so angry he'd wanted to kill the young man who had been a companion and almost friend. But he'd never told Ailsa what had happened. He had a hard enough time saying anything at all. Ailsa put her hand on John's knee.
"I can wash your clothes tomorrow if you'd like. Leah and Zoe can help me. I wouldn't mind."
John's stomach clenched with knots of embarrassed confusion, but Ailsa was kind to everyone. She was pleasant and thoughtful. He felt his cheeks starting to burn and his neck itched. Zoe arrived with a mug brim with cider.
"Thank you for saving us, John Hunter," she said in her little voice.
He accepted the mug and took the first sip, and the dazzling sweetness danced on his tongue. He loved this kitchen. He loved the Abbey. He would lay down his life to protect them all, but his mouth just couldn't say the words he longed to say to the woman who made him blush and made him hope for something more.
"I can manage it," he said to Ailsa and took another swallow of cider,
and he winced at the look of disappointment that shone in her eyes.
I hope you enjoyed listening to The Hunter of Muirwood by Jeff Wheeler, narrated by Peter Franson of Christian Geek Central. If you want to read more by Jeff, go to jeff-wheeler.com to find more of his books. While you're there, sign up for his newsletter, which has some additional freebies for you to snag. I especially loved the bonus chapters for his newest series, The Invisible College. Those chapters sucked me into his newest world, and I immediately bought the first book in the series. If you enjoyed listening to Pater narrate the story, you might also enjoy listening to his audio dramas at spiritblade.com or his podcast, Christian Geek Central, where he discusses movies, video games, and all things enjoyed by self-proclaimed geeks from a Christian worldview. If you haven't already entered this month's giveaway with prizes from our featured authors, make sure you do that. There's just a few days left. You'll find it at findingfantasyreads.com/giveaway. But I also want to make sure you all take the time to vote for your favorite Finding Fantasy Reads stories from this season. Last year, I had just a few simple categories, and I made you all vote for your favorite story out of all of them, which was near impossible with so many episodes. This year, I have broken it down into categories to hopefully make it a little easier for you. You don't have to vote in every category, but take a look at each one, and if one of the stories stands out as one you remember enjoying, vote for it. Pater and I will also be choosing our favorite ones to narrate, and I'll be looking at stats to determine which episode was most popular. But if you want to have a say in the listener awards, you'll want to go to findingfantasyreads.com/vote to get your vote in. I'll leave the voting open for 1 week, and then about a week after that, I'll announce the winners in a short bonus episode. Otherwise, this is my farewell for the summer, because I take June and July off to spend that time with my kids. I hope you have a wonderful summer filled with lots of fantastic books. Thank you all for listening, and happy reading.